Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey there, it's Aaron Newton. Great to have you with me. Another week on the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Castrol in 2024. And since I started this podcast back in 2019, our guest today is a guy I've had on the I've got to get him on the podcast soon list. It's taken me a few years, but I finally got there. Softly spoken, Paul Radisich has always let his driving do the talking, and it's been that driving that took him to the top of world motorsport. So many of our Sleuth listeners know the story of the Rat, the days of racing in the British Touring Car Championship during that amazing super touring period, coming back to Australia and racing V8 supercars for a range of teams and winning the FIA Touring Car World Cup twice over, including once when he wasn't even accepted as an entry. More on that in the podcast. So many achievements, so many stories, but there's a lot more to the story of Paul than that. An open wheeler career that many people have forgotten, that was an amazing run. We'll explore that. We talk a little too about his family background. I've always meant to ask him. Indeed, he's a Kiwi, but his family roots run much further afield than that. Now, I always enjoy my chats with Paul. He's always been so giving of his time. And in this pod, he opens up about some topics that I've wanted to ask him about for a very long time. So let's rip in. Part one of Paul Radisich. Enjoy this episode of the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Castrol. Paul, great to see you, mate. I know it's down a computer line and in the information superhighway, as they say in the old days. But how are you, mate? Aussie race fans don't get to see or hear much of you these days. How are you travelling?
No, pretty low-key, really, as far as motorsport is concerned. So I do a little bit with the British Touring Cars on TV3. And I was at the supercars last weekend. And, mate, I keep an eye on you guys. How about that?
Oh, that's a worry. That's a big worry. We can't get anything past you. So motorsport to you now, is it in the past? Is it just a case of keeping an eye and just an ear out for what's going on, but you're so busy running your business and having a real job that having an active involvement in motorsports, there's not really the time for that these days?
Well, it's sort of, I guess, Aaron, it's turned out a bit like that. In the last 5 years, I've been involved with some of the endurance racing down here. I've been doing classic events, Goodwood and the Power Touring event last year at Brands Hatch. So I still keep involved and I still love driving. Every time I get behind the wheel of something, it turns back the clock about 30 years and away we go. It's amazing what memory muscle can do, you know, but I still enjoy the driving. Yes, business does take up most of my activities. So when it comes to the weekend, I'm keen to rest up a bit and just see what's happening in the motorsport world. So to answer the question, I keep an eye on it, but yeah, I'm not heavily involved.
I was going to say too, mate, one of the things that when we did a call out to our listeners and our V8 Sleuth readers of our website and our socials, there were some common themes that came up, but one of the ones that popped up with a few people, but not many, getting your surname correct. We heard years of Murray Walker screaming Radisich, and there's been all sorts of variations and versions, and I'm sure because of the nature of you, you'll go with whatever. But can you categorically 100% tell us how to pronounce your surname correctly.
Well, it's Radisic, but I prefer Murray's way to do it, really. I mean, I had the entire world at one point calling me Radisic, and if it was easy to say that way, then say it, you know. So, as you know, there was the rat and the rat attack and everything else associated, but Radisic is how it is pronounced.
We'll go with that. So I've been largely correct for most of the years. I'm going to take that. What's the – obviously we know you as a Kiwi through and through export, you know, racing overseas, racing here in Australia, racing in New Zealand. What's your family's background and heritage beyond New Zealand? Because I'm so interested in the name.
Well, it was Croatian, of course. And last year we visited Croatia for the first time, and we took a speedboat around all the islands to get to, because we only had about 4 days to go around pretty much all the islands. So literally a speedboat to all them. So we went back to the grandparents' place and, you know, all the morbid things that you see, and checked out the family home, which is still in Vis. So it was really good. So my grandparents there, they escaped from the war, travelled around the world, and ended up in New Zealand, and did all the gum mining and things like that. And then they moved to a farm and had a family, and that's where we appear. So the history is Yugoslavian and Croatian. And, you know, my parents grew up here, and my dad's heavily involved with business, Shell service stations, car yards, all the normal, you know. We're either, as a family, we're either going to drive them, work on them, you know, or sell them. So we really didn't have much of a choice. Or for me, it was going to be a jockey, but I believe it or not, I was too big to become a jockey. So motor racing it was. So, you know, my dad was heavily involved and a key mover for, like most of us boys, you know, the family are a key ingredient to the early days.
Was it always going to be a case that you would follow the automotive pathway, whether it was racing cars, working on cars, being around cars? Was it always, from as far back as you can remember, being the thing you were going to somehow do, come hook or crook?
I think so, Aaron. It started for me in motorbikes at a young age, mainly because the industry, the racing at that stage for go-karts was not that popular, and the motocross scene was big in this country. So as a junior, I sort of started there and worked my way up to the seniors. But by the time I got to sort of 16, I'd pretty much had enough of broken bones and lying in hospital for a fair bit of time. So I thought, gee, the cars would be worth a look at. And, of course, I had a good chat to my dad and didn't take too much convincing. And then from there it was like, well, what do we do? So we started in saloon cars, and him and I teamed up, and we sort of took on with a little Toyota Trino, and it took on the big V8s, and I had some great tussles, and that's how I sort of got noticed. And then there was a matter of saying, well, what's next? And next was formula racing. So somehow we managed to grab enough shekels together to buy an RT4. And with the help of Shell and a lot of friends, we started the process.
Did you have the idea that you were going to go be a Formula One driver, or is it a case of I'm just going to go and do this, and wherever we land is wherever we land? Because it's so hard for Australians, Kiwis, to come from this corner of the world to make it at that upper echelon. Were the stars in the eyes back then, or was it a case of no real plan, let's just go and see what we can do?
Yeah, look, initially there really wasn't any great plan, and I don't think it was any great plan at any time. But once I started to do Atlantic and throw a bit of speed, and then I did Australia, and, you know, the likes, and learnt my craft for the likes of John Smith and Medeki and Costanzo and John Bow and all those guys that I followed and admired and looked up to, and then I was racing them. So, and then when I started racing with them and was competitive with them, it sort of changed a bit. And then it's like, well, you know, what about Formula 3? And Formula 3 was the step to Formula 1. You know, Senna had just broken into Formula 1 and Brundle and people like that. So it was just if you did well there, you had possibly a chance of so that's yeah, when that happened, it was like, gee, maybe I'm gonna try for Formula 1 and I managed to scrape together enough dough and enough supporters to do bits of seasons in Formula 3 and with a little bit of success as well.
There's always talking to everyone I've spoken to on this podcast, there's people who make a difference along the way, people that you meet who open an opportunity, who open their wallet, who introduce you to somebody. In that era before, I think a lot of our listeners and readers, they know so well your history with V8 supercars, with the British touring car stuff, with the Mondeos and that stuff. But the open wheeler, the pre-British touring cars, is kind of a bit foggy for a lot of them. So who made a difference in that era there to help you get to those opportunities in British Formula 3 and a bit of racing in America and Atlantics? Who made the difference back then that you look back on and go, geez, without that or them, I wouldn't get to where I got to?
Yeah, well, initially it was parents to start with, and then it moved Australia. Graham Watson was a big supporter for me and helped me with all my things in Australia and racing for Rail to Australia back here in New Zealand. So he was a big part of my early career. And then moving on to America, I spent a long time standing on the outside of the tracks, waiting for an opportunity, waiting for somebody to, couldn't make it the race, money would run out. I'd be the guy that would be out there waiting for something to happen and going to the races and doing that. So it did it the real hard way. There really wasn't any one person that, and that's probably where I lacked. I lacked that one person just to help me push and get some doors open, because it pretty much was just me. And then when I managed to open a few doors, people like Kerry Agapu and Indy Lights, Bill Simpson in Formula V, Dave Conti, which people may not have heard of him, but he ran a great Super V team. Dave McMillan was a big help in getting me some rides with Route America. So it was sort of a whole host of people that were helping to get me some rides. But behind it all, it was just me trying to hustle and talk to these people and convince them that, you know, if there was an opportunity, I'd be the guy to stick in the car. And I remember one story was I was winning lots of races in Super V, and then I got an opportunity to do Indy Lights just as a one or two off race. And then I remember talking to one of the IndyCar teams. Sorry, the name eludes me right at the moment, but they were a top team, the IndyCar team. And I said, "Hi, I'm Paul Radisich. I'm doing Super V and da da da." And he said, "Oh yeah, we know who you are." And I said, "What would it take to get a test drive with you?" And he said, "Oh, we'd love to have you in the team. And why don't you come down to the shop and have a look around, blah blah blah." So I did all that, and then finally got to Tintax and was like, "Well, if you come up with $1 million, you'll be in the car." So it was my first reality check on maybe I'm not going to get anywhere in the series by trying to find the money anyway.
One of the things that we've been going back through this week before we were sitting down here in our office, and the boys have found some stellar photographs from those Formula Pacific years, and you doing the Australian Grand Prix at Calder Park, as it was back then, on that short track against some of those F1 stars of the day. But putting all that aside, the big, big question I have to ask is, what was with the mustache, the moustache, Paul? It was horrible. It was 1980s at its finest. Would you like us to burn those photos?
No, nah, keep them, mate. That's part of history. You know what that was all about? Because I was so young looking at 17, 18, I looked like I was 12. So it was like, well, I better grow a moustache so I can get into the nightclubs. And it worked. And it worked. Yeah. And that was it. That
I was knew there was a reason.
Yeah.
Love it. Hey, tell me about those. I think I can't remember exactly the year. Maybe it was 83, 82, somewhere around there. A lot of our listeners think of the Australian Grand Prix as being Formula One at Albert Park and Adelaide before that. But there was a time where the Grand Prix ran at Calder for Pacific Cars in the early 80s, and Prost and Lauder and Piquet and Rosberg and Moreno, some of the great names of Formula One at the time and in the years that followed came out here. I mean, you got to race against them in essentially almost your own backyard.
Yeah, and that was I think I did it a couple of times, I think, but with Route Australia with Graham Watson, he put me in the car and we qualified fifth or sixth. So to be right up there next to Niki Lauda and Alain Prost and Moreno was the man to beat in those cars. It didn't matter who hopped in them. He could beat anybody. So for me, you know, as a young guy to qualify in that field, and I think I was running, I'm pretty sure I was running fourth in the race. And from memory, the last two or three laps, the rear wing fell off. So I think I finished sixth. You'd have to check the results, but I finished the race sixth or seventh with no rear wing. So great experience. And, you know, there's lots, you know, for us. Australia was a big part of my early career growing and to understand motorsport and gave me an opportunity to move, you know, further afield.
And as you mentioned, there was British F3, there was some stuff in America. Where did touring car racing come on the radar for you in that 80s period? Was it a gap filler between open wheeler opportunities, or what was the scenario that got you there into some stuff with some roofs on top of them?
Yeah, it was. I was racing in America with the Indy Lights and Super V, and just really wasn't making any progress, because of funds. So I had an invite to come back and do the Nissan Mobil and Bathurst with Bill Bryce in a little BMW 325.
M3.
Yeah, well, before M3, it's their little car before, you know.
Yes. So the 325 before the M3. Yep.
Yeah, I think it was ex Tony Longhurst car, you know, and then the M3 come out and superseded it. So we run that car in New Zealand, and I teamed up with Denny Holm, which was great. I mean, Denny was a great supporter, helped where he could, opened a few doors, enjoyed being down with him at his house in Rotowiti, and it was great. So to team up with Denny, and he said to me, it'll never leave me, he said, I feel like driving today, boy, because I started. He said, make sure you're there at the stop. I said, yes, boss.
No pressure.
No problem. Yeah, no pressure, yeah. So we did well in that car. It was a little bit outclassed, but we did really well, and Bill was a great supporter as well. And all of a sudden some doors started to open up, and Peter come knocking, Peter Brock, and we shared the car and the Nissan Mobil. We won the Nissan Mobil. I was in his team with Bradley. Brad Jones was I think I was his co-driver, I think. Maybe the other way around.
Depends who you ask.
he crashed, so he must have been my co-driver. No, he didn't. I think we had a mechanical problem. But from that opportunity, Dick Johnson in 90 offered me a ride with Jeff Allam in the Sierra, and we finished second at Bathurst. So that's where it started, you know, once again through Peter and Dick, and and then it progressed until eventually I had to make a decision if I was going to go touring car racing or try and you've got to remember I did 10 years with single seaters trying to get a career in IndyCar, whatever, who cared, as long as it was a career. But it came to a cross point where I had an Indy Lights program on the table, which was semi-funded, and then I had the Works Ford offer, and that come really through Peter Brock, Alan Gow, Andy Rouse, because Andy Rouse had, sorry, I'm going back over, but Andy Rouse joined Peter Brock when I was in the team. He knew of me, you know, that's sort of how things progress. But so when I had that opportunity with Alan Gow going to Britain and said to Andy, why don't you, you know, looking for a second driver, why don't you put Paul in the car? So that's how that all sort of come about. So when the offer came, it was like, I've got two offers, one single-seater, one touring car. If I step away from a single-seater dream, that'll be the end of it. But here's a career that I've been looking for, to have some sort of permanent work, a career, and with a works team. So it was, it sounds like a no-brainer, but when you're in the position going, God, what do I do? And I remember talking to Alan Gow, and I said, look, Alan, this is a situation I've got. And he sat there for about 5 minutes listening to me waffle on, and then he came back and he said, are you a bloody idiot? He said, probably. He said, it's a no-brainer, you know, like works driver, you're going to get paid to come and race cars, you're going to go somewhere. The other thing may fall over, and so that's how these things go, and that's how that went. So I signed the contract and ended up spending a few races standing on the sideline. So I got a works driver in my pocket, Andy Rouse, Ford Escort Cosworth to drive as a road car, money in the bank, and the car's not competitive. So anyway, that's a whole different chapter.
It is, and we'll cover the super touring stuff. We'll bundle that together in a sec, but I just wanted to skip back. So the Bill Bryce opportunity with that little BMW led to teaming up with so the next year you drove with Ludwig Finauer, who had been the engine guy at Frank yes. Gardner's JPS team. So your first Bathurst 1000s in an M3 with Ludwig in 88, the year that Tony Longhurst and Thomas Mazzera won the race. What do you remember about going to Bathurst for the first time?
You know something, I don't remember too much of that. I think we must have gone out with mechanical problems. So do you remember,
Aaron? I have to consult the data. Yeah. I've got a database here for a very good reason, Paul, for very questions good. Like these.
Yeah, well, I mean, Ludwig was great to work with. And of course, he'd done a little bit of driving, but because he was part of the team on the – you know, on the maintenance side of it, he didn't do a lot either. So, but well, I just remember we got on well, we raced well. I just don't remember if we finished or not.
I can tell you. Well, you did. You were 19th and the last classified finisher, 48 laps down on the winner. So I can only presume you had some form of drama during the day, and it probably felt like you didn't finish, but you are officially
that's probably
on the
don't
result
remember,
sheet
yeah.
as a finisher. Yeah, exactly right. So that was the entree to a long time of running at Bathurst. So when I look back at it, in the end, for the 1000, you made 17 starts in that race. It should have been 18, but that's a story we'll go into a little bit later on. But, I mean, it became a big part of your career, particularly when you came to Australia on a full-time basis, but you still came out and did the co-driving stuff. Tell me about that era of racing with Brock, the Mobil Sierras, that kind of helped that next section of the British touring cars, because Alan Gow was running Brock's team with him, the Mobil Ford team. Of course, Andy Rouse, as you mentioned, had sold the cars to them to Australia, hence That's he cool. came out and was a co-driver for a couple of years. But it always seems like there's stories with Brock, Gow, all those blokes tied in together. It sounded like it was good times. And then you add Bradley Jones in the mix, and it's a crazy little team.
I think firstly, being involved with PB was you know a real big thing because of who he was, who he is, what he did, and the type of personality that he was, and you know we spent quite a bit of time. We'd go out to his farm, and so when you were involved, you got heavily involved with him. And you know, I remember when we drove together at Pukekohe, and Peter was always a, and he didn't have to really work at anything. He just hopped and turned the boost up and went, put some soft tires on and went, and that was it. And it's like, well, okay, you go and do all the setup, you know, Paul will do all the setup, get it reasonably right, and then I'll just come in and do the last five laps and set the headlines. And that's pretty much how it went. So, you know, pound around all day and get all this and do all the donkey work, and then Peter turned up literally half an hour before the end of the session, and they threw on some sticky bridge stones, and boom. Brock fastest.
Yeah. Sounds about right. The I was going to say, mate, those Sierras of the period, you drove the mobile cars, the shell cars. At the time, they were such a car to have, particularly until the Nissans came along. But looking back on them, they were so rudimentary. They were brutal. I mean, what's your initial impression when you think of those cars now?
Oh, just the acceleration that the – I remember Bathurst, and you just put your foot down and it would literally push you back in the seat, which is such a great feeling, you know. But I tell you, when you went up over you know, around the top, and the lag, particularly when they were running reasonable boost at 2.1 or 2.2 or something like that, there was a lot of lag. So you had to drive them a bit like a Formula 3 car where you'd roll through the corner. And you'd hope like hell that when the boost come in, the car was straight. So there was a lot of hoping that you weren't going to fire off into the wall, because if you're if the boost come on, you're a little bit through the corner or not far enough through the corner, it would just light up like you can't believe. So they were great cars. And when you look at them now and you look back and you go, oh, God, hell, how do we – drive with such small tires, you know, and such big power, but they were tremendous cars.
We mentioned Brock before, and our Aussie listeners will absolutely get and know he was bigger than Ben Hur in Australia, but I don't think Aussies probably understand he was pretty bloody big in New Zealand too. Give me the snapshot of where he stood, particularly in that era of the Wellington Street races that he won, some of those with Alan Moffat. Mobile were big in New Zealand, backing that event, backing him. I mean, he was big ticket over there. It wasn't like he could suddenly not be recognised where he went when he was the other side of the ditch.
No, 100%. You know, he was just as popular on this side of the ditch as he was, you know, in Oz. So, you know, look, the functions that he spent more time, you know, more time functions every night, and people wanted to book him for, you know, for whatever. So his schedule was, you know, the racing just sort of got in the way, really. So his schedule was pretty full on. And hence, you know, I joke about you set the car up, but, you know, he was out doing work, you know, TV, radio interviews, punting around, looking after sponsor stuff, doing group talks. So that's what his, you know, that's what he was doing, and that's how he did it. And so, as I say, I think the racing was, even though it was primary, the amount of time that he really put into it was less than what he was doing on the PR side.
Importantly, in that mobile era too, you mentioned it before, that whether it was you were Bradley's co-driver or he was yours, I'm not sure. That's a whole nother podcast topic, I'm sure.
You should ask Brad on that.
Oh, we'd have a five-hour episode if we ask him about it. But do you have a good Bradley Jones story that you can tell us that we will not be sued for?
there's over the years, I think, I drove for Brad in the Super Tourers at Bathurst.
At the Audi at Bathurst, which I think a lot of people forget.
Even I trouble remembering. But Paul Morris and I teamed up in his car, and I think Brad had a lot of. At that stage, I'd come. You know, I was pretty competitive in Super Tourers, and when I come out, I think Brad. He said to me, look, this is a situation. You're going to have to be co-driver with Paul. Paul's got the, you know, the end of the day. It's his gig. So you're just going to have to toe the line. And I said, yeah, Brad, no problem at all. I don't think he believed me, but you know. So I think if there's a story with Brad, that's probably one of them. He found it quite difficult to talk to me about that, you know. And at the end of that, I was quite happy to just get in and do my little bit for the race. So, saying that, there's lots of stories. Even on the weekend, we see Brad here at the Taupo race, and you know, just to catch up with him. And then there's, you know, Brad, there's 101 stories, you know.
Probably 100 of them we will get sued for that we can't tell. Probably a good thing that we don't. It's such a great era, that Group A touring car era, where it was very much an international formula. Obviously, it fell apart after that, and 2 liter became the international formula. But I mean, Mobil team, Dick Johnson's team. Let's go back to that. You mentioned it earlier about that runner-up result at Bathurst in '90 with Jeff Allam, and I think Jeff's told the story on another podcast. There's that famous thing of Dick trying to get in the car to do the last stint because you could cross-enter the drivers back in those days. Couldn't get the seat to move. Had to put you back in. You finish off the race, finish second. Jeff tells the story that he jammed the slider for the seat. Is there any truth in that, or do you think he's just telling a good yarn?
You never know with Jeff. He's a bloody idiot. He should have let Dick get in the car. We would have won the race. And that's what I said to Jeff. See, if you hadn't have done that, we would have won the race. Because, I mean, we lost it by the amount of time that we lost in the pit, you know, was stationary. So, you know, ifs and buts and maybe don't really matter. But, you know, something I don't think Jeff did that. I really think the seat just jammed, because we never practiced Dick trying to get in the car. And, you know, that we never tried if the seat would go far enough back. And as it turned out, you know, in the panic, one thing we did write is that Neil Lowe said, look, you get your stuff on, you better get ready because, you know, Dick's going to hop in the car. I thought, thank Christ for that. it's another 20 less laps I have to do. And so I was, at least I was standing behind Dick when he jumped in, couldn't move the seat. And, you know, at least everyone had the presence of mind to go, right, I can't, you know, you get in. So if we, you know, if I wasn't ready or wasn't there, we wouldn't have ended up second. So, yeah, it's a great story. It just shows you sometimes you need to practice everything, right? Not just, you know, in those days you could cross enter and Dick could drive any of the cars. So those days are well gone.
Yeah, that's right. It's a rule that still wrangles, I think, a lot of race fans, particularly because Peter Brock took advantage of it and won a couple of Bathursts that way. But everyone had the same opportunity in those top teams. He was the only one who could sort of turn it into a win. Now, we covered before the pathway to you getting to that British touring car opportunity, the Ford Mondeos with Andy Rouse, that factory program. But you mentioned before how you signed up, you got a road car, you had a deal, but you didn't have a race car. And wasn't that because originally the Mondeo 2 liter touring car was going to be rear wheel drive, and then they found actually this is no good, we need to go to front wheel drive, and that delayed getting a car on the track? Is that how it all played out from my memory?
Yeah, pretty much, Aaron. It's, you know, Andy was adamant that the program, the car should be rear wheel drive, and in some respects, that's, you know, rear wheel drivers. Always nicer to drive and to get the best out of, you know, the rear wheels burning, but Yeah, we did. He did everything. He tried, you know, Just lost too much power. And by the time he sort of worked out that it wasn't going to work, we'd already lost about four races. I think four, maybe five. So it was a scramble overnight because Ford said, "Look, we've got to go racing. Either bring the rear wheel drive out or ditch it, you know, and go front." So overnight, Andy wheeled out all the Toyota measurements and basically just turned the rear wheel drive into front wheel drive and we went out to Pembrey without even I'd never driven front wheel drive in my life. Actually, that's not true. I drove a one make Ford Fiesta, I think it was, about a month before. So other than that, I'd never experienced front wheel drive. So we went to Pembrey. What the hell's this? The torque's there. I'm going from one side of the track to the other. I needed three arms just to hang on to the thing, you know. So Andy did a little bit of testing prior to that because this car was ready first. Surprise, surprise. And he qualified on the front row. So that was really good. I qualified ninth, I think, in my first race. And he didn't finish the race, and I did. So I got to understand, you know, what to do with front wheel drives and how to drive them, and it sort of went from there.
You could have never guessed that at the start of that season, you don't have a car, you've got to swap it all around, you've missed races. But by the end of the year, you are the FIA Touring Car World Cup, effectively the world champion of touring cars. Talk about a turnaround. What a year.
Yeah. And bizarre, isn't it? How it, you know, it's, you know, that year in the UK, the car just got better and better and better. We swapped to Michelin tyres. And all of a sudden, when we did that, that just gave us that little edge. And, because the Mondeo, the engine right up the front, in that era, 93, 94, 92, 93, 94, that all the engines were in the standard position. But the Mondeo, being a V6, was always heavy up the front, and the Michelin tyre really handled that quite well. And that, you know, catapulted us right to the front. And as the season went, in British touring cars were able to win the last, I don't know, four or five races or something, which catapulted me up into third in the championship. And then talk about things happening. And then so that which was brilliant, you know, and it was looking really good. Then all of a sudden this, the FIA World Cup sort of burst into life. And because I was the only person from New Zealand, it had to be a team, and then they wouldn't let me enter because I wasn't a team, being a one man band. So our entry was declined. So here I was, the inform winner of the whatever in Britain, and we couldn't get an entry. So I think between Alan Gow and the FIA, they allowed me in at the last minute and then I blew them all away. Yeah. So, it's bizarre. It just went from, you know, I don't know, one disaster to another. So, but there was a shining light and that was a shining light.
And it was a light that kept shining.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I remember being at Monza. I'd never been to Monza before, and go out and go look around me, and there's Stefan Modener and Tarquini and Lorini and Nannini and all the Houdinis. It was more, you know, it was just Italians everywhere, but the, you know, it had even Mark Scaife was there. How about that? So it was every champion of the world in touring cars, and then there was 19 Formula One drivers. So it was pretty special. and to come away with pole for the two races and win them was amazing.
Is that something at the time is a great thing, but looking back on it now, you can only really see it as wow. That's, and not just that one, you backed it up the next year at Donington and won it 2 years in a row. So, I mean, that's got to be something so very special. I loved, we talked about this before we came on air and started recording, but you were really gracious back in your days here racing in Australia to have me come and visit you to do a magazine interview. We won't go into how many years ago, it dates us both, but you were kind enough to show me those two World Touring Car Cup trophies. They are unbelievably special because there were only ever three World Cups. The last year in 95 was at Paul Ricard. You've got two of the three that have ever been awarded in the history of touring car racing. That's mega special.
Yeah, it is. I'm not giving them back either. it was a day in time or a weekend in time. As you say, it only happened, for 3 years. And then it sort of went on into the World Touring Car Championship then, I think, didn't it? Was what happened. But, it was very special. Didn't have the right car in the second year. All of a sudden, Super Tourers were starting to become single seaters, and the engines further down into the car, and it started to become, to win it, you needed huge budgets to do that. So, for the second year, we didn't, the Alphas were the car to beat, but once again, Michelin come to the fore for that particular race, and it was a better durable tire which worked well on our car, and they were in the days where you could do plenty of testing, so I tested every type of compound that they had, and I worked out what I needed for the car to not only one, give it speed, but two, give it durability. And that was the key to winning the second World Cup anyway.
And the really cool part of that is that car, I believe, that's the car that's in New Zealand that Scott O'Donnell owns, who has backed Ryan Wood, who's in supercars with Walkinshaws now. And you've driven that car. That is the 94 World Cup winning Mondeo.
Yeah, it is. Yep, it is. We took it to Brands Hatch last year and run around there. I mean, it was uncompetitive in 95, so in 2023, it was even worse. But I tell you, talking about that, what a great event! Literally, it was like time standing still. We, Brands Hatch, Stephen Richards went over, Greg Murphy, myself, Nigel Arkell, and in the Honda, and the crowd for me, it was like, oh, Paul, I met you when I was, 7 years old, 6 years old, or whatever it was, and now I've got my son. I want to introduce you to him. Honestly, it just went like that all day. It just, people, it was like, it literally was living the day. How long ago that's, Aaron? Was it 30 years?
Long enough, yeah. So, I was going to ask you that. It's amazing, isn't it? Does it blow your mind that people are that British touring car era of the 90s, whether people saw on their highlights on their sports shows in Australia or New Zealand, or they went to the rounds in Britain? I mean, it really grew to become such a massive thing, but it's got a very soft spot in the hearts of racing fans all over the world.
Yeah, looking. At the time, it didn't matter if I went to South Africa, Europe, obviously around the UK, Australia, back to New Zealand. People knew your name was yelled out. And it was just that whole championship just captured the imagination. I think it was a time when Formula One wasn't that popular, racing wasn't that great, and all of a sudden these lunatics turn up on a racetrack, crashing into each other, And actually, I've got a great story with Alan and that. I remember one of the beginning of, I think it was 94. We all got sat down, all drivers, say, look, there's too much bumping and bashing going on. Just, you know, you got to stop it. These are the rules. Somebody hits up the back, you're going to be penalized. You know, we don't mind a little bit of touching, but nothing too much. So all of a sudden, there'll be big fines. So all of a sudden, the next two rounds, it was very boring. No one would, everyone was too frightened to pass each other or lean on each other. So anyway, back into the school board room we go. Look, boys, this is you know, this can't happen. You got to keep racing. So we're going to allow you to do anything you want, other than you can't drill anybody from the back. So there was lots of things like that went on over the time, because you know, the television coverage is what made that series. And you know, places like Donington and Brands Hatch, we literally couldn't get into the circuit. We'd have to meet outside, and the helicopters would fly us in to get into the track. I mean, they were you know, we're talking 60,000-70,000 people trying to get into these venues to watch the racing. So yeah, it was a huge time. And then people like Nigel Mansell come back and did a race, and you know, and I think Brands Hatch, when he came back and did it with, and I was teammates with him, he drove the Mondeo, he drives Andy's car. There was 120,000 people come out to you know, watch him throw himself into the bridge.
Oh, that's right, it was too. Yeah, at Donington, yeah, off the Craner curves. Yeah, he ended up. Yeah. I think he rode Andy's car off, not yours. So not so bad for you. It was not your car. So.
Didn't matter. Let's build another. I think that car was so badly damaged, they crushed it all up and gave it to him as a coffee table.
It doesn't surprise me. It was if you haven't seen it, have a look at YouTube to our listeners, because it's a nasty accident that he's actually really lucky to get out of that without some bad injuries, because before the days of the cockpit side intrusion and the wraparound seats and all the stuff that we take for granted in top line supercars and touring car racing these days. But I wanted to talk to you about that era. You said about how big it was. I mean, the money that was getting thrown by the manufacturers, it was like an arms race that just kept going up every year. The cars got aerodynamics. Williams got involved with Renault. There's TWR with Volvo. 888 come along later on. Pro Drives in there. There's all these powerhouse manufacturers and engineering companies. I mean, in terms of money, budgets, it was really off the charts. And I guess if you're looking at your earning capability as a race driver and as an athlete over the journey, that's got to be the peak of anything that no one could match again. That was insane stuff that will never be repeated.
Well, I'd never say never, because it might comes around. I mean, probably sports cars took that back over, and, you know, Formula One. I mean, everything has a cycle, right? You know, that sort of that decade cycle, doesn't matter what it is, it seems to keep reproducing. It's just a matter of what formula that goes into. And yeah, you're right. I mean, Super Touring, you know, with all those 20 manufacturers in it, they were spending some big money, you know, like £2-3 million just on diff. You know, yeah, diff's a big part of the whole process. But, you know, their budgets of, you know, probably in Formula One terms are still small, but for, you know, budget of £20-30 million, it was big money for touring cars. And, you know, unfortunately, only one manufacturer can in those days dominate or win. So the others were sort of getting fed up of having to spend that sort of money to try and be competitive. And, you know, that's what sort of killed it in the end. But while you're in that particular time, you know, for being a driver, the amount of notoriety, the amount of sponsorship, and you know, the amount of involvement in it, and you know, you were, for me, you know, I was somewhere in the world, different place every week, either testing a Mondeo in Australia or South Africa, throughout Europe. So you know, it was a great time.
Did you hang on and stay with the Ford program too long? It left Andy Rouse's team. It moved to West Surrey Racing later on down the track. The wheels kind of fell off it there, and you went missing for a couple of years. Did you have the chance to go somewhere else, or did you stay loyal to the Ford thing because you'd been given your opportunity there?
Yeah, I did. I stayed too long, and I was too loyal. I should have, you know, I had, you know, you look back and you go, well, you know, at the time I had offers from BMW, Alfa, Volvo. I ended up finally leaving Ford and taking the opportunity with Peugeot, which wasn't a good one. But I'd made a decision that because the Peugeot was not competitive in Britain, but the French Peugeot was a great piece of kit. And the talk was, look, two-year deal, we're going to just have to run this car out for one more year, and then we're going to hook into the French program, and all their cars and the right people and so on and so forth are going to be coming over to do it. So I took a punt on that. I thought, okay, one year's another year paying, what the hell, for one more good one. But unfortunately, Peugeot at the end of 98 pulled out. So that's what happens.
The best laid plans. But there was one single season with those Peugeots, but if you remember, you did come and do Bathurst the previous year and share one with Tim Harvey, which was the 2 litre Bathurst. But I wanted to just refresh, maybe you can tell our listeners here to just join the dots on something for me, and you'll know where I'm going very soon. So who was – so the Peugeot team was run by MSD. They had staff, they had engineers, they had mechanics. They had a PR manager as well, like all race teams do, Paul. Who was the PR manager for the Peugeot British Touring Car team?
Well, I don't think it was Patricia. Yes, it was. My wife, Patricia. Yeah, it was. Yeah, but I think when I joined, she retired from that position.
So had you already started dating before you turned up?
Yes, Aaron, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you went to the team and wooed the PR lady?
No, it wasn't. No, Patricia and I an item before, way before that. So, that's a whole chapter in itself, yeah.
Go on now. Where did you meet?
I won't bore you.
We love to know. We love to know this. We love to know this. What did you do on the first date? Did you take her to a race meeting? I'm guessing yes.
You're probably right. I can't remember that. You're probably right. She was involved in motorsport, so she knew the rules. Yeah.
And that's where this part of my chat with Paul Radisich is going to stop. But I've got very good news for you. Part 2 is already loaded and ready for you to listen to now. I'm not going to make you wait another week or any other time. It's ready to go now with tales of V8 supercars in Australia, the days with Dick Johnson Racing, and how he managed to fight back from two nasty crashes at Bathurst and so much more. Also, we get to the National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions that you've so kindly sent in for him to answer. So let things roll on from here with the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Castrol. Part 2 of Paul Radisich is ready for you now with plenty more stories from the Rat. Enjoy.